RockZone.com.
Now, TalkZone presents The Bob Woodson Show, What Works and Why, insights and solutions to some of America's most troubling societal problems. Featuring community activist Robert L. Woodson Sr., who has spent decades promoting solutions to some of the most challenging problems facing our nation today. Now, here's your host, Bob Woodson.
Welcome, everyone. This is Bob Woodson. We're pleased that you're joining us today on our new series, The Bob Woodson Show, What Works and Why. Today, we're going to take a look at the black family. We're going to be looking at research. We're going to be looking at what is it that we should be trying to measure when we're talking about violence reduction. And we want to know what is the impact on the culture in which troubled kids are being raised. Since a lot of these young people are from African-American families and communities, we want to take a particular look at the black family and its role in the situations that we're facing. Today, we have two guests. Dr. Robert B. Hill is a retired sociologist. He previously was a senior researcher at Westat Research Firm and the director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University, research consultant to the White House, senior research associate at the Bureau of Social Science Research, and director of research for the National Urban League. He is the author of the landmark book, The Strengths of Black Families. He published this important book in 1972 and has updated it twice since. He has written many other important publications on the subject of informal adoption among black families, as well as various articles in the Urban League's The State of Black America. Our second guest is Dr. Ivy Tolson, who is a senior research analyst for the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, an assistant professor at Howard University School of Education and the Department of Human Development and Psychoeducational Studies. He is the author of Breaking Barriers, Plotting the Path to Academic Success for School-Age African-American Males, published by the Congressional Black Caucus. He also is the lead editor for the policy monograph Policy, Race, and a Proper Role of the State Funded by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. And I know Bob Hill for a long time, and we can say we have three generations represented here. Bob Hill, and then we have Ivy, and I'm somewhere in the middle, don't I wish? But I think it's fascinating to have this kind of intergenerational dialogue among two outstanding scholars. We're going to talk today about the challenges facing the black community and incarceration rates, teen pregnancies, low marriage rates, and crime. All these things are reported in the black community in numbers disproportionate to the number of blacks in the country. And so to help us with this, Bob and I were discussing before we start this whole issue of research. You know, we've been talking about reducing violence in and the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise Violence Free Zone program that has been operating very successfully for about 9 years and dramatically reducing youth violence. And one of the issues that that keeps coming up is this whole issue of measurement and evaluation. How is it that you measure? What should we be measuring? And the Baylor University, of course, we had a show with the two scholars that who've been on the ground with their case studies and informing us that when we go into a school, violence goes down 25% during the first 3 months. Suspensions are dramatically reduced. Expulsions decline. Overall, we do climate surveys, too, where the parents, teachers, and students are asked how they feel about it, because we also know that the fear of crime can be as much of a factor in altering behavior as the actual incidence of crime. So, Bob, we were talking about this earlier. What is it that researchers look for, and what are some of the myths about research and evaluation that I'll ask both of you to comment on?
Well, I think that one of the major deficiencies of traditional research on any social issue is that we are fixated on studying the problem, the weaknesses, and not the strengths. In other words, we'll spend millions of dollars studying the lady that's on welfare, But we don't spend money on how these ladies got off welfare, or the kids who are joining gangs. How many of them are in gangs? We'll have a complete enumeration, but we wouldn't study how some of these kids got out of gangs. In other words, we can get much more money studying the problem than studying the solutions to the problem. That I consider to be the basic flaw of most research.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And it's often referred to as the deficit perspective. We study the deficit instead of studying the strengths. Another problem with research, especially as it relates to research that looks at a particular racial group, is that we tend to focus on comparing races. So we'll compare all black people to all white people. And what that does is it gives the illusion that the entire race has this problem. And so one of the things that I try to focus on in my research is not looking at all African-American males versus all white males or Latinos. I look within the group to look at the high-achieving black males and compare that to the middle-achieving black males and low-achieving black males, because we know that the just like you mentioned before, the ones who are doing well, they have to have a very savvy way of navigating some pretty tough situations. One example, just quickly, there was a kid who I knew who had to travel through gang territory to get to school. And what he had to do is he had to change the color of shoelaces every day just to walk through a certain community. And so if you look between the races, you won't be able to capture some of these strategies that kids use in order to survive in some pretty tough areas.
Boy, that's fascinating. Someone said if you wanted to learn how to play the piano, you wouldn't go to five people who failed and say, would you teach me by what you failed to do?
Right.
We would go to one person who has mastered the instrument and sit at their feet and say, teach me what you know. Mm-hmm. But you're saying in social science research, it's just the opposite.
Right.
Someone said you can't learn anything from studying failure except how to create failure. Mm-hmm. And so what both of you seem to be saying is that there's so little. How many studies are there on strengths? I know Bob.
Well, let me say, over the years, I mean, I wrote my book in 71 on blacks, and that was the first one that talked about, because we don't assume that low-income people have any strengths, white or black. But there have been many. They're increasing. They're looking at Hispanics now. They're looking at even Native Americans. And so they're beginning, but they are still an infinitesimal number compared to those that look at the weaknesses of families, particularly low-income families. So yeah, they're going in the right direction, but we still don't have that as more of the norm.
So, but what we were talking about earlier is that a lot of these coping mechanisms, you're saying that we just don't capture that.
Right.
When we were in Chicago a few weeks ago, you said something that I remember, Ivy. When a young student asked you, what should he do when he has a teacher that is hostile to him? Mm-hmm. And really doesn't care whether he succeeds or not. And I think he was expecting you to say, well, I'll file a lawsuit against the student, against the teacher, or I'll take action against the. And what was your response to him?
My response to him was that, in a nutshell, and I gave him a lengthy response, but in a nutshell, the best revenge against somebody who wants you to fail is success. And so, and I gave him a personal story about a similar situation that I had with one of my teachers, and I went to a school that sounded pretty very similar to the school that he went to, that was majority African American, yet most of the teachers were white, some of them very good, but others really didn't seem to have the kind of compassion for their job or for us, and brought a lot of stereotypes into the classroom. And I told him a similar situation that I had and how I was able to really change the way this teacher thought and her whole perspective by being very successful in her class and being successful on my own terms. There was term papers that she didn't want me to do because she didn't believe in any race-based research. And so I knew that, you know, after she initially rejected it and I told her that I would have to take it beyond the class, she reluctantly let me do it. And I told him how, although the maximum number, or the minimum number of pages required was 4. I gave her 12 pages. I gave her 4 pages of references when she only asked for about 3 references. and you know, that was the strategy that I used to deal with her. And so, that seemed to resonate pretty well with him.
Yeah, you know, you seem to be acting in a tradition of going back in history. In 1943, when blacks were not in the Navy, there were no naval officers. Mm-hmm. And Eleanor Roosevelt, God rest her soul, was a true champion of social justice. And Eleanor Roosevelt pushed the Navy to train 13 blacks as naval officers. Mm-hmm. Well, like you, the Navy said, okay, what we're going to do to just dismiss this is to give these 13 recruits in 8 weeks what we normally give a white candidate, 16 weeks. And so they put them in a barracks and in a base, and they started to the training program. Well, when these 13 cadets found out what the game was, they did what you did. They put blankets up at the window and stayed up all night and studied. So at the end of the 8 weeks, when the Navy rolled them out and tested them, they scored in the 92nd percentile. Mm-hmm. So then the Navy said, well, they must have cheated. So they took them in individual rooms and tested them separately. And they collectively scored in the 94th percentile. Well, it still took about 6 months with Eleanor Roosevelt's insistence.
Right.
But they were finally commissioned as naval officers, and many rose to rear admirals. And I met one or two of them in Norfolk who have been long since retired. But these kind of stories, this kind of ethic, it seems to be lost today. It used to be prevalent, and I'm just pleased to see it in young people like yourself. But
right.
I guess the question that it begs is, what happened prior to the 1960s? If you look at some of the numbers, the incarceration rates for blacks in 1954, when the Supreme Court Brown versus Education was passed, reflected the percentage in the population.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 20s, it's reported that when the newspapers ran a headline that the black out-of-wedlock birth, Bob, was 15%, it was a scandal.
Mm.
And now, in 1960, something happened, all of that changed, to now it's 70%.
Right.
So what do you think has happened?
Well, let me just say, particularly on the impact of the black family, but I think it's also our society. One is, there are certain factors, changes in terms of both economic forces as well as policy. For example, one of the things, you're right, certainly before 1950, it was low rates of family breakup, and said, but what happened also was that we're talking about in the 60s and 70s. One was the exodus of jobs. There's a very strong correlation between family instability and economic instability. So we had the exodus of jobs moving out of many of the inner city areas. The other was that we also had, over this time, certainly was the infusion of drugs, massive. And in the past, those drugs used to be to adults. We used to have more, and they used to be men primarily, with the heroin. Now we have cocaine, crack cocaine, which affects us not just the father, but the mother. The other thing is that we also have the increase now of guns. Guns, which used to be not available to young people, are available. Kids can get guns quicker than they can get ice cream cones. And so that we have a confluence. And there's a lot of forces, both policies and forces, that I think in our urban areas disproportionately impacted blacks. Now, let me say this. The female-headed household breakup occurred among whites, except it has steadily gone up, except that it is a lower rate among whites than blacks. So it is still disproportionately among blacks and then also Hispanics. But there was a combination of a lot of the – also, one of the factors that's left out is urban renewal. Also, during this time, communities were broken up, and people had stronger communities, and they were spread all over the place. We usually leave that out of any of our analyses. So there was a combination of these which disproportionately affected blacks, but I think the real thing was the economic indicators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. And something happened around the 80s. And one of the recent analyses that I did, I used census data to look at cohorts of African Americans. And the age group right now that has the lowest gap between whites and blacks among high school graduates is people who are about 40 years old right now. So black males who are 40 year old right now, the gap between their graduation rate, the likelihood that they have a high school diploma versus a white male is only 5%. And so if you look at older black men, it widens. And if you look at younger black men, it widens. But there was a lot of progress that was made up until the time that they graduated, which was around the 1980s. And we do see in the 1980s, there was the introduction of crack cocaine. Even though crack cocaine wasn't a new drug, contrary to popular belief, people have been freebasing, which is essentially the same thing as crack cocaine. But it was the availability of it in very large supply in urban areas. And there was this trade aspect of it. You had a lot of young people who were just getting very rich very quickly. And then at the same time, you had different types of enforcements of that, of those drugs. And so you had these drug task force that were going through these communities. Crime that used to be a misdemeanor all of a sudden carried 15 years. And that switch happened so rapidly, a lot of people didn't know about it back then. And so working in the federal prison, I saw a lot of young black men who sold drugs in their early 20s, but they had 15, 25 years with no violence. So there was a lot of things that broke up the community around that time.
Well, this is why I think some of these issues really need to a deeper analysis. And, mm-hmm. and there are some troubling questions I know from my experience that I have when I look at how the black family fared during the 10 years of the Depression, mm-hmm. where there was, intense racial antagonism as a matter of state policy and 25% unemployment of white American, like 40% black, but yet our marriage formation rate was higher than the marriage formation rates of whites. There must be something else going on internal that affects the decisions that people make and the choices that they take. Because even today, if you go into certain inner cities, into black Muslim communities, you don't see the drug addicts and the drug dealing and some fundamental Christian communities like the House of Prayer, Bob, here. In their little enclave, so where does the whole value base and choices that people make based upon certain value generating institutions? But before answering that, we'll have to take a break. And we're talking to Dr. Robert B. Hill and Dr. Ivory Tolson. And I'm Bob Woodson, President, Center for Enabled Enterprise. And we'll return after these messages.